Hello, everyone. I'm Father Ray Petrucci. Welcome to Thoughts for the Week. We have a wonderful program for you and one in which I'm sure you can learn a great deal. And we're going to get to that in just a minute. First, I'd like to invite you, our listeners, to consider giving us your input. Some thoughts, ideas, perhaps topics you'd like us to investigate. Love to hear from you. You can do so two different ways that I'd like to give you, either simply putting a stamp on a letter and writing to us. And in that method, please just send your letter to Thoughts for the Week, Post Office Box 7466. That's 7466, Greenwich, Connecticut. Now, the zip code in Greenwich is 06836. That's 06836. If you're on the computer and prefer emailing us, please do so at the following, clemons10@aol.com. That's, I'll spell it for you, C-L-E-M-O-N-S, the number 10, at aol.com. While you're on the computer, I invite you to go to our internet magazine, Spirituality for Today. You can find that at spirituality.org. That's spirituality.org, and that's important. If you put com, you'll be wandering off somewhere else. Spirituality.org. You also could hear our program as well as articles and other features. Thoughts for the Week is available online for you. Well, first I'd like to welcome my co-host, Mrs. Dorothy Riera. Delight to have you with us.
Thank you, Father. I'm excited about our fascinating program today.
And fascinating it certainly is. Isaac Newton once said that gravity explains the motion of planets, but it cannot explain who sets the planets in motion. And we have a woman here who certainly has contemplated all of those things. She happens to be an associate professor of biology at Sacred Heart University here in Fairfield, Connecticut. And we welcome her, Professor Suzanne Duchesne. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Father. Nice to be here.
Well, we're delighted to have you and back again. And what a fascinating world that you operate in, the world of science, also bringing faith into that world, too, which I hope will influence in many positive ethical ways that particular world. Well, we know that you are a professor of biology. Do you have a particular area that you're really interested in or involved in?
I'm nuts about genetics.
In fact, I
make my students laugh. When we get to the part of the class where we study DNA, you know, our genetic material, I show it and it's like a twisted ladder, and I sort of do this little gyration with my body, and I say, oh, this is my favorite molecule, you know, and they all laugh at me, and they think I'm nuts, but I really do think that DNA is quite beautiful, and you can see the work of the Creator in this. You know, it's just simply a fascinating molecule, and how it's inherited, which is the study of the field of, you know, the genetics field, is the study of inheritance, is just fascinating. So I've always liked to study genetics. I've mapped genes, located genes on chromosomes. I've studied how they function. Mm. And now I'm studying the ends of chromosomes that carry genes. These are called telomeres, and they shorten as we age. And so we're asking whether horseshoe crabs that are found on our local beaches have these shortening phenomena that we see in humans and other organisms.
Now, the horseshoe crab, isn't that just, something goes back to the age of the dinosaurs?
450 million year old living fossil that
wow.
has remained essentially unchanged in all that time. It is doing something well to have survived this time.
To survive, yeah.
It may have a lot to teach us.
Absolutely.
When we think about the workup, and oh boy, I'm so excited. I hope I get this even remotely right. The idea of DNA, or let's call it deoxyribonucleic nucleic acid,
oh,
more or less.
Oh, we had to memorize.
Close. Very good.
Thank you, folks. And our listeners, I will. You can send me letters of appreciation.
If you studied in Catholic school, you had to learn, the nuns made you learn how to pronounce the
yes.
word.
Yes.
The nuns, boy.
That's funny.
But when we think about DNA, is this something that will cause scientists to wonder whether you're looking at, I guess I'm wondering what maybe the end game of all of this study of DNA, what is the great thing hoped for in all of that?
Speaking for myself, first there's the passion to know, to understand, the inquiry, the, you know, where, what is this? How does it work? You know, that just that standard curiosity about life. But ultimately, I would say that myself and others, we try to understand how genetics works, how DNA works, not only to know it for its own sake, which is very valuable and good, but also to impact our society in some way. So in human genetics research, we do work in that area to better the human lives around us. You know, we want to eradicate disease. We want to have better ways of treating disease, you know, preventing it, warning people what's coming down the pike. We also study genetics to impact our interaction with the environment. So if we understand population genetics, we understand species and how they live in their particular niches, we can better understand, you know, their genetics in that way. Then that helps us conserve them and protect them from loss as a result of our own activities, you know. So we can find ways to better preserve species, preserve our environment by studying genetics as well. So there are a lot of benefits, not just for us in particular, but for the many organisms that we share this planet with.
The idea of dealing with illnesses, that's a very noble thing. But is it, just keep thinking of, is the goal longevity, which may happen, or is the goal simply a healthier life for as long as how that natural process exists?
For the most part, I think it's to improve and better one's life. As a secondary effect, you would live longer. There are definitely scientists who are studying longevity in many different organisms, and we're better understanding how aging occurs. And I would dare say that we've called it a fountain of youth race sometimes. But I don't think that's the main role of genetics research.
Well, I always wonder about that. I realize when I was born, from the time I was born, I think population of the world has more than doubled.
Yes.
Now, if that occurs again, I mean, there's a point where there's simply going to be too many people to sustain us. Or if you create something where everybody lives for thousands of years. Now, and you know you can't keep adding more people, so therefore we have the same people for thousands of years, which kind of deadens everything, creativity and everything else. It's almost like that natural process of living and dying is really an important
reality. It is a natural, absolutely.
When I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, you know, the living and dying is such a big part of nature. It's just like if you look at animals, they live a certain time and they pass away. And some live 75 years, others' lives are 14 years. So it all depends. But I do think that that expectancy of how difficult it has become now because people are living a lot longer, so there's a lot more medication to keep these people living
being
longer.
Kept longer through pharmacy rather than more than anything
exactly,
else.
Exactly, you know. Exactly.
And well, this brings us to another time. I realize we're in the other end, but it's just fascinating when I ran across this. The three-parent baby. What can you tell us about three-parent babies? Oh, my gosh, what's going on?
What are we coming to?
What's going on?
So we're all familiar with, you know, the egg and the sperm coming together to form a new life. So with the three-parent babies, we're trying to get around a genetic defect in mitochondria. So mitochondria are these small little compartments. We have hundreds of them in each of our cells. And they're compartments that generate the energy that our body needs to extract from the food that we eat. So I call them powerhouses of the cell. They all contain a small amount of DNA, actually. They're derived from an old event between a large cell and a smaller bacterium. The large cell engulfed the smaller one, the bacterium, and instead of breaking down the bacterium, it allowed it to survive. That bacterium provided benefit to the larger cell. The larger cell provided benefit to the smaller cell. And over time, this changed to become today's powerhouses. That DNA can develop negative changes in its sequence. when that happens, you can have disorders of muscle and disorders of eye. There's various mitochondrial disorders. So mom is the one that passes on those to her children. Only mom, because mom's eggs contain mitochondria. The sperm do not introduce mitochondria into the egg when they go in. Only the DNA of the sperm comes into the egg during fertilization. So mom may have, let's say 50% of her mitochondria have this bad DNA. She passes that on to her children, and then they develop these disorders. So the idea is, in such cases, can we change mom's mitochondrial DNA? Can we get rid of it and replace it with healthy mitochondrial DNA, right? So what happens, there's many techniques. There's three different techniques for doing this, but I'll just tell you in general what happens. We take mom's egg, we take out her bad mitochondria, and we put in fresh mitochondria from a donor egg, and then we fertilize it either at the same time or afterwards, okay? Or we can take a donor egg, take out its genomic DNA, take out the nuclear DNA that would determine the next child's characteristics, and put mom's DNA in there minus the mitochondria. So however you put this together, you have mom's DNA, dad's DNA, and a donor's mitochondrial DNA. 1, 2, 3 parents.
Mm.
And there are some scientists that take issue with the term three parent, because the one who donates the healthy mitochondrial DNA is not donating characteristics that give you hair color or function of the heart. Those genes that are found in the mitochondria are used to support your metabolism and other functions that you wouldn't necessarily see. So regardless, three people are involved.
It's almost like an organ transplant or something.
It's a type of transplant.
A simple way.
And this is done outside of the womb.
Outside of the womb.
In a laboratory.
Correct.
And then this fertilized egg is implanted inside the womb.
Correct. And so this is a tricky technique, and it's been used successfully, I believe, in one instance, and it was outside of this country. And so it's being investigated now for other births, because in those conditions where mitochondria are defective.
How does the mother know that she has this defective gene prior to having the child?
There may be a family history of this disorder, and then she herself got tested. She may not show the effects of this disorder. She may herself have it. Most of them are pretty serious, though, so she is not likely to have it, but she will carry those genes. So if she has family members, she would get herself tested and realize, uh-oh, I'm carrying this gene. I should have my eggs edited, or somehow, not edited, but I mean undergo the mitochondrial transfer replacement.
When we think about gene therapy, is that what we're beginning to get into? Or is it something like, well, my father died of a heart attack in his 40s, my grandfather died of a heart attack in his 40s. Is that, or is something like, guess what, you're going to have keep an eye on that in your 40s, and there's nothing much you can do about it?
So this is similar to the idea that, you know, I have a family history, my father died of this, and then my uncle died of this, and now I have a high risk of dying of this. So it's similar to that, except that you don't inherit it in the normal DNA you get from mom and dad.
Okay.
So these mitochondrial disorders come with mom's eggs in those tiny little compartments, the mitochondria. So it's mom's fault, so to speak.
So could that be like part of, that would have, like, if there is a Down syndrome in the family, that would apply to that?
No, that's a different,
totally.
Correct, okay. Yeah. These are very rare disorders, and they're only found in those little compartments called mitochondria, but Down syndrome and cardiac defects and other issues that we suffer from, those all are inherited in the nuclear DNA, which is what is found in the large control center of our cell. So that DNA is what is being a problem for most genetic disorders.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
When you take a look at the whole area of all of this genetic manipulation, some ways, are we, or I just want to bring faith into it, ethics into it, are we looking at a time where we're going to have designer children, that type of thing?
That is a big fear that is often voiced by the lay public and even among scientists. We have discussed this amongst ourselves as well, that a rogue entity may choose to develop a so-called designer child who would have characteristics that are desired, like a certain eye color, athletic traits, intelligence. Of course, we cannot design such a child easily because multiple genes would need to be tweaked, and that's very difficult to do. We're having a hard time tweaking one gene. Now we're talking about many genes. Yet we are in some ways designing our children when we choose amongst embryos. So if we do in vitro fertilization and we choose those embryos that do not carry a certain mutation, for example, Down syndrome, and we don't implant those embryos, and we are effectively selecting against them. So we are designing, in a way, the child we want by choosing and not choosing. You can do sex selection. You can choose children that are female or male. That, in a way, is a type of selection, a type of design. It's not manipulated, but we are fast growing, you know, we're fast approaching the point where we do have to ask this question seriously, because we are now editing human embryos. This just came out last week in the journal Nature that we were able to edit successfully a cardiac defect in an embryo, a human embryo, without introducing other changes in its genome. So this is now possible to change one gene, and it might be a series of a bit of time, but we'll may be able to change multiple genes. And so, you know, rogue entities who want to create certain children might go forward, you know.
But then again, the cost of all this has to be astronomical.
Absolutely.
Because I'm just thinking, just to go into a lab and do these sophisticated testing, or even I think for parents trying to just do a normal fertilization outside of the womb is very costly.
So then you get into a different ethics issue. So there's the obvious ethics issue of, you know, discarding embryos and manipulating embryos and potentially affecting future generations. That's a big problem right there. But then we've got the other problem. Who is going to be able to afford to do this? So are we going to further stratify society? Are we further going to choose who's going to be able to manipulate their children? And you know, it'll be those who can afford it.
I mean, there's something, you're in the sci-fi realm in some degree here in the sense that it's almost a Hitler-esque type of thing of superiority. And if you end up with a whole generation of superior people as they determine themselves, how will they deal with that mom and dad who are obviously inferior?
Correct.
Is that like the term that they use, genetic engineering?
Yes.
Because that's what they're doing.
Yeah.
Genetic engineering can be used for good or the bad, right? So genetic engineering is essentially a good descriptor for what we're discussing. So anytime you cut and move and repaste DNA sequences together, you're doing what's called genetic engineering. So in this case, if you're designing a child, you're engineering. Now, here's a scary thing that maybe most listeners don't know about. Scary in some respects, not so scary in others. So the prospect, we have now gotten to the point where we can assemble DNA manually or using sophisticated instrumentation. And we've done that with very small organisms like bacteria. We've assembled genomes. We've assembled their chromosomes from scratch, from chemicals, and hooked up the chemicals one to each other. Well, that's a major feat, but these were tiny organisms. When we talk about the human genome, we have 3 billion base pairs. That means 3 billion letters that we would need to assemble. There's no instrumentation currently that can do this, but scientists are really, really discussing this possibility. Here's why. If we can assemble a human genome from scratch, we can understand how its parts work. Think of it like a clock. When you want to understand how a clock works, you don't just look at it, you take it apart. Right. And scientists feel, and I understand this thinking, if you tear something apart to its component bits and then you reassemble them, you can better understand how they work together. And if I tweak this piece, what will that do to the whole works? If I tweak that piece or remove it or add an additional one, what will happen? We don't understand our genome at all. So this would be a way to do that. What's scary, and you can use this for treatment, by the way. You could tailor, you know, certain genes into cells and put those cells in your body, those cells have been engineered to not be rejected by your body and engineered to produce something that your body's not making, for example, insulin. So imagine that, to have a cell line that could be tweaked to your specifications, making whatever your body's not doing. So that's a good application of this, okay? What's a bad application? It would be as if you wanted to design your perfect human, or if you wanted to change some things and create what some people fear will be a Frankenstein, a monster, you know? So sometimes I think we get a little too overhyped on the Frankenstein scenarios because we've seen too many sci-fi movies and books. We've read too many things. The media is very hot to report these nightmare scenarios. In reality, it's going to be very hard to do it, but we are certainly discussing the possibility as we speak.
Getting away from the human manipulation, I guess I'm thinking of, I hope I'm correct here, genetically modified organisms, that type of thing, or they almost like you have to put a sign on products that you may buy. I guess most of the corn or some of the things we produce now already are affected by that. I guess I'm asking, is there any real concern about that, or what issues arise from that particular work?
You raise some good questions, and it's a very contentious issue, this whole genetically modified organism, GMOs for short. So you can modify plants, and you can modify animals to have certain characteristics that are desirable. So as it turns out, 80% of U.S. corn, soybean, and cotton are genetically engineered, so they're GMOs.
To do what?
To resist herbicides. So, for example, a farmer has to get rid of weeds in order to get the maximum yield from his or her crop. So weeds are in the way. So we now dust our fields with herbicide. Well, herbicides are poisons, and these end up on our food supply. So in order to reduce the amount of herbicide, if I can engineer a natural biological herbicide into my crop, it will prevent resist the effects of the herbicide, because the herbicide will kill off my crop as well. And I will, or if I engineer weeds that have something that is self-destructive, you know, we don't do that, but we actually engineer herbicide-resistant crops so they don't die when we dust our fields with herbicide. Insecticides. Insects eat our crops.
Yes.
Problem, big problem. Engineer a natural insecticide into the plant. Now the plant doesn't die, the insects die. Okay, so now I don't have to apply as much insecticide on my field. So this is a plus. Here's another one, engineering rice to produce vitamin A, which is a nutritional deficiency in some third world countries. We call this golden rice. So if we can put carotene and vitamin A into this rice, we now have a crop that's more nutritious. What about arid soils in certain parts of Africa? Okay, they can't grow crops very well because there's limited water, or maybe the nutrient content is terrible. Grow plants that are modified that can grow in those areas. So there's a lot of good. We've even modified, there's economic gain, never mind human nutrition, salmon. Salmon have been genetically engineered to grow faster, so we can now send them to market faster. Now, the FDA has determined all animal GM products they have to go through this very, very strict regulatory process, and the meat is substantially equivalent to what we eat already. There's no harm. They've been tested for allergens. The same is true for GM plants. They're tested for allergens, and I think what makes people worried is, well, what if there are unintended consequences? You know, by engineering the genome, I introduce something else.
That may affect your immune system.
Correct. We don't know. And so what people don't know often scares them. And I personally have no problems using GM crops. But in Europe, there is a lot of concern, and they want people to know so they can make choices based on their own, how they feel about their health and what they want to be exposed to or not. Again, everything is tested very, very tightly, very, very strictly, so that you don't get this incursion into our food supply. But you can't 100% watch everything. And so I think that's what makes people scared, is that occasionally things can slip into the food supply that shouldn't slip. And then you would have trouble finding it.
Would you consider this among the challenges of 21st century science?
I think one of the biggest challenges is related to this is feeding our human population.
Mm. Yes.
You brought up earlier, Father, that our population is doubling and tripling and growing, and some of it is the food supply issue. Some of it is having governments that prevent food aid from coming to their people. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of political structures that prevent food. There could be enough food in some cases, but it doesn't get to the people. Mm-hmm. But in many cases, you've got famines, you've got droughts. What do you do? So feeding all these people, climate change,
water,
there's just an amazing a number of things that limit the food supply. So I think that's one of the biggest challenges.
Mm.
Another challenge, I think, is scientists communicating with the lay public in a better manner. We have a lot of technical, sophisticated jargon that we are not good about explaining. And we have not always been good about consulting with the public. We are much better in these last few decades, but people's memories are long, and they remember Nazi Germany.
Mm-hmm.
They remember the Tuskegee Institute study.
Mm-hmm.
They remember all of these eugenic policies that we had here in the U.S. that in some ways spurred Nazi Germany's eugenic policies.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to do a much better job about communicating our intent, our purpose, what we hope to achieve, and engage the public in a more meaningful way, perhaps. And I think another challenge that goes along with that is educating our children from the get-go in science, because our population isn't as well-versed in science as we should be. And so we're making decisions about climate change based on unfortunate misinformation. We're making decisions not to vaccinate our children when the vast majority don't experience side effects, and that's based again on misinformation. So we need to better educate ourselves, and as scientists we need to better communicate what we're doing. Those are the biggest challenges, I think.
Is that tied in therefore to the application of faith to science?
Yeah, I think that there's been an unfortunate polarization between faith and science in this country, and to the point where the two don't trust each other at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very unfortunate. We've become very fundamentalist in the broad sense of the word. So scientists are perceived as all agnostic or all atheist. We're not all like this. Mm-hmm. There's a new Catholic Society for Scientists, actually, that just started last year, and I'm very excited about. And we need to be listening to faith traditions in science, because they will keep us informed on the ethics and the higher purpose of what everything is doing. But faith needs to listen to science too, because sometimes faith gets stuck in this rut, and it's unfortunate.
Well, incredibly, we're all out of time. We've been listening to Professor Suzanne Duchesne on the area of faith and science, and I hope everyone has learned something. And God bless all of you for being with us. Join us again next week. And Dr. Duchesne, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you, Doctor.